I'm sorry. What did you just say? Have you met Tish? That child would not run if the house were on fire. And those travel girls have been playing since birth. No, thank you. We are trying to help her, not humiliate her. Abby, I've got a hunch here. She's a natural leader. She gets the spark in her eye when we talk about soccer. I think she might love it. Me, no chance. She's way too fragile right now. What if she doesn't make it and it breaks her? Abby, what if she makes it and it makes her? Behind my back, Abby called Craig, a lifelong soccer player, and it quickly became 2-1. The plan was to approach Tish and ask if she'd like to try out for an elite travel soccer team against my will and better mama judgment. One day after school, all three of us sat Tish down. She froze and looked warily at us. After a divorce, kids are in fight or flight mode for a long while. She asked, "What happened? More bad news?" Craig said, "No, no more bad news. We're wondering if you'd be interested in trying out for a travel soccer team." Tish giggled. We didn't giggle with her, so she stopped. She looked at Craig, then me. Then her eyes locked on Abby. Tish, wait, are you serious? Abby, yes. Tish, do you think I could actually make it? I opened my mouth to say, well, honey, the truth is that these girls have been playing much longer than you have, and don't forget that just trying out is so brave, and we will not focus on outcome, just our input. But before I could speak, Abby looked Tish dead in the eyes and said, yes, I believe you could make it. You have potential and passion. Somebody's got to make it. Why not you? Oh my God, I thought. She is reckless. She has no fucking idea what she is doing. Without taking her eyes off Abby, Tish said, okay, I'll try. Awesome, Craig said. Cool, Abby said. Danger ahead, I thought. We three smiled at Tish. Tryouts were 4 weeks away. Tish, Abby, and Craig spent those weeks at the elementary school practicing shooting and in our living room watching old women's national team games. Abby and Craig traded texts and emails about training strategy. Tish and Abby talked about the game so incessantly that soccer became the official second language of our home. They also went for runs together each day, which never went smoothly. Tish complained and cried the whole way through. One afternoon, they walked into the foyer together, sweating and panting. Tish continued her run right up the stairs, stomping the entire way. Before she slammed the door to her room, she screamed, I can't do this. I hate it. I can't do this. I froze and began to consider what medications we might prescribe Tish after this dangerous experiment failed and we had officially ruined her life. Again. Abby turned toward me and looked into my eyes. It's fine, she said. She pointed upstairs. That's exactly right. Don't go up there. She'll be down in a bit. Tish came downstairs in a bit, red-eyed and quiet. She sat on the couch between Abby and me. We watched TV for a while, and during a commercial break, Abby said, without taking her eyes off the TV, I hated running every single day of my career. I cried about it all the time. I did it because I knew I couldn't be great if I wasn't fit, but I freaking hated every minute of it. Tish nodded and asked, when are we running tomorrow? The weeks pass, and now we are driving Tish to her first day of tryouts. I have both my hands wrapped around a gigantic travel mug filled with stress relief tea. When we arrive at the fields, all the other girls are in their shiny travel uniforms, and Tish is in a summer camp t-shirt and PE shorts. She is also at least a foot shorter than all of the other girls. When I point this out to Abby, she says, what? No, she's not. Babe, when it comes to Tish, you've got some kind of projected body dysmorphia. Look closely. She's as tall as the rest of them. I squint and say, Well, she's littler inside. Abby says, no, she's not, Glennon. No, she's not. Tish, Abby, Craig, and I huddle up. Tish looks at me and her eyes are watery. I hold my breath. Abby looks at me and widens her eyes. I want to say, "Baby, let's forget about all of this. Mommy's got you. Let's get back in that car and go get some ice cream." Instead, I say, "I believe in you, Tish. This is a hard thing to do. We can do hard things." She turns away from us and begins to move slowly toward the field. I watch her walk away from me and toward this very, very hard thing, and never in my life has my heart traveled so far up my throat. She looks so small, and the sky, field, and task ahead of her are so big. She keeps walking, though, away from us toward the sideline bench where the other girls are sitting. As soon as she makes it to the bench, she and we realize, oh my God, there is no room left on the bench for her. She stands awkwardly off to the side. She doesn't know what to do with her hands. She is on the fringe. She is outside the golden circle. She does not belong. She is not one of them. Abby grabs my hand. "You okay?" Me. "No, this is a mistake." Abby. "This is not a mistake." I grab my hand back and pray, "Please, God, if you exist, make them be nice to my daughter. Make them invite her into the circle. Make the ball go into the goal every time she touches it, or just create some other kind of soccer miracle so she'll somehow make this team. If all else fails, send an earthquake. But please, God, let this be over soon, because my heart cannot take this." Tryouts begin. Tish doesn't seem to know what she's doing. She loses the ball often. She isn't as quick as the other girls. She looks over at Abby several times, and Abby smiles and nods at her. Tish keeps trying. She has a few good moments. She can complete a pass, and Abby insists that she has some kind of vision of the field, an understanding of the game that seems to exceed the other girls' vision. But the hour is tough on her, and me. After it's over, we walk to the car together and climb in. Tish is quiet the whole way home. After a while, I turn around and say, "Baby?" Abby puts her hand on mine and shakes her head no. I turn back around and stay quiet the rest of the way home. We go back to tryouts the next day, and the next. We go back every night for a week. On Friday night, we get an email from the coach. It says, "She's got a lot to learn, but she's got a spark, and she's a hard worker and a leader. We need that. We'd like to offer Tish a spot on our team." I cover my mouth and reread the email twice to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. Abby is doing the same thing silently over my shoulder. I turn around to her and say, "Holy shit. How did you know?" Abby has tears in her eyes. She says, "I didn't know. I haven't slept through the night for 3 weeks." Craig, Abby, and I sit Tish down and tell her together. "You made it," we say. "You made the team." It's been a few years since those tryouts, and now we are parents who spend our weekends carting our child all over the state and spend our money on gas and hotels and tournaments and cleats. Tish is strong and solid now. Not because she wants to be a model, but because she wants to be the best athlete and teammate she can be. The stronger she is, the more her team can count on her. Tish does not consider her body an end in itself, but a means to an end. She uses her body as a tool to help her achieve a goal her mind and heart have set: win games with my friends. Tish is a leader now. She has learned that there are great athletes and there are great teammates, and they are not always the same people. She watches her teammates and she decides exactly what each needs. She knows who is hurting and who needs encouragement. After every game, win or lose, she sits in the back seat on the drive home and sends her teammates messages. "It's okay, Livy. Nobody could have stopped that ball. We'll get them next time. We love you." The girls' parents write me emails saying, "Please thank Tish for me. She was the only one who could console my girl." Tish is an athlete now. When drama hits at middle school, it doesn't shake her badly because those hallways are not where she finds her identity. She doesn't need to manufacture false drama in her social life because she has all the real drama, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat on the pitch. The other day, I heard her say this to a friend of Chase's. "Nah, I'm not popular. I'm a soccer player." Soccer saved my daughter. The fact that I didn't save my daughter from soccer saved my daughter. Recently, Craig, Abby, and I sat on the sidelines in the cold, pouring rain and watched Tish's team play. The girls were soaking and freezing and somehow showed zero signs of being either one. I watched Tish closely, as always. Her legs and face were both chiseled. Her long signature braid was perfect. Her hot pink pre-wrap headband held back strays. The other team had just scored, and she was trying to catch her breath and get back into position. As she ran, she called back to her defenders, "Let's go! We've got this!" Play resumed. The ball came to Tish. She trapped the ball and passed it to her forward, Anaïs. Anaïs scored. The girls ran toward Anaïs, toward each other. They all met in the center of the field, a mass of tween girls leaping and hugging and celebrating each other, their team, their sweat. We parents cheered too, but the girls didn't hear us. In that moment, there was no one else on earth but them. How we felt about them didn't matter. How they felt was what mattered. For them, it was not a performance. It was real. The game ended, and Abby, Craig, and I walked to our cars, parked side by side. We all climbed inside to get out of the rain. After a quick team huddle, Tish walked toward us with her friend Sid. They were not hurrying because they didn't even feel the cold. When they got to us, they hugged, and Sid walked off with her mom. Tish came over and stood outside Abby's window to say goodbye because she was going home with Craig. It's still tough, all this back and forth between houses. Divorce is hard to navigate. All families are hard to navigate. But Tish knows that she can do hard things. The rain continued to fall around her, but Tish's face was a floodlight framed by the window. She said, "Coach Mel gave me a nickname today. She says she's going to call me Elmers because the ball sticks to me like glue. When she called me off the bench today, she yelled, 'Elmers, you're in.'" Craig's window was open and he heard her story. He smiled over at me and Abby. We smiled back. Tish just stood there between us, glowing and gluing. Luckies. When Abby and I first fell in love, we had hundreds of miles and a million obstacles keeping us apart. The facts laid out in front of us made a future together seem impossible. So we'd tell each other about the true and beautiful unseen order we felt pressing through our skin. Our imaginings always included each other and the water. Abby wrote this to me from the other coast one evening before she fell asleep. "It's early in the morning and I'm sitting on our dock watching the sunrise. I look and see you in your pajamas, still sleepy, walking toward me, holding two mugs of coffee. We just sit there on the dock together, my back against the piling, your back against my chest, watching the fish jump in the sunrise. We have nowhere to be but together." The harder things became, the more often we'd return to that morning Abby had imagined for us. That dock, her, me, two steaming mugs of coffee. That image became our unseen order, guiding us forward. We had faith. A year later, Abby made dinner for the six of us, the kids, Craig, and me. We all sat down to eat on the back porch of the home off the Gulf of Mexico that Abby and I bought together. It was a gorgeous evening, the sky all purples and oranges, and the breeze steady and warm. We ate and laughed, and then cleared the table together. Craig left for his Sunday evening soccer game, and the kids finished the dishes and then sat down on the couch to watch a show. Honey, our bulldog, snuggled up on Emma's lap, and Abby walked outside to our dock, the Doyle Melton Wom Dock. I watched from inside as she sat down with her back against a piling and looked out at the canal. I poured two hot teas and walked out to join her. She looked back toward me, and by her smile, I knew she was remembering. We sat on the dock together, my back against her chest, her back against the piling, and we watched the fish jump while the sun set and the sky celebrated in deeper and deeper purples. Before we went back inside, I snapped a picture of us, smiling, with the sun setting behind us, and later I posted it. Someone commented, "Gah, you're so lucky to have each other in this life." I replied, "It's true. We are terribly lucky. It is also true that we imagined this life before it existed, and then we each gave up everything for the one in a million chance that we might be able to build it together. We did not fall into this world we have now. We made it. I'll tell you this, the braver I am, the luckier I get." Buzzes. I used to hate romantic movies. When they came on the television, I'd feel achy, like I was looking at pictures of a party I hadn't been invited to. I'd remind myself that romantic love is just Disney bullshit, but I'd always feel a yearning right before changing the channel. Like the yearning that Abby, who is agnostic, feels when she watches a church choir with their robes and deep voices and shiny eyes. I've always had shiny eyes about divine love. I'm a believer. Abby has always had shiny eyes about romantic love. She's a believer. Abby's favorite movies are Romeo and Juliet and The Notebook. The Notebook. When I say to her, "I cannot believe we found each other," she says, "I can. I knew you were out there the whole time." I didn't know. I didn't know about romantic love because I didn't fall in love until I was 40 years old. There I was, just walking down the street of my life when I fell into a rabbit hole. This is why they call it falling in love, because there is suddenly no solid ground beneath you anymore. When I fell in love, I felt a lot like I did when I ate hallucinogenic mushrooms with my friends in college. When the mushrooms kicked in, we'd fall into the rabbit hole together. Suddenly, I'd feel utterly connected to the people I was tripping with and equally disconnected from everyone sober. My friends and I were in a bubble of love, and no one else could reach us or understand us. I felt sorry for the sober people. They didn't know what we knew or feel what we felt or love like we loved. We called them the normal people. "Be careful," we'd whisper to each other when one of them would approach. "She's normal." For a long while, that was how I felt about everyone who was not me and Abby. I'd look at folks walking down the street and think, they don't even know. We are special, and they are so normal. The only normal person I could even speak to during those early days was my sister. She talked to me back then exactly like she'd talked to me when I was a drunk. She'd cock her head to the side and say things like, "Be careful, sissy. You don't really know what you're doing right now." I'd think, "Oh my gosh, she thinks this is a phase. She doesn't understand that I have found love, and so now I am different and special forever. This is what I've been missing. This is why life has been hard for me, because I didn't have this one thing. Now I am better. This is who I am now. I am me and Abby." One night, Abby and I were sitting on the couch, wrapped around each other, kissing and talking about eloping. Abby said, "We gotta be smart. Our brains are lit up like Christmas trees right now." I pulled back from her. I felt confused, like one of my shrooming friends had turned to me in the middle of a trip and asked if I would help her with her taxes. I felt lonely, like Abby had abandoned me and become normal without me. I felt annoyed, like she was suggesting that our love was not personal but chemical, like it was not magic, just science. I was under the impression that our love was the opposite of the drugs that we had used to light up our brains and escape our lives for decades. I was under the impression that we were healing each other, not drugging each other. I was under the impression that we were Juliet and Juliet, not Sid and Nancy. Abby said, I'm afraid for when this beginning part ends for you. What do you mean? You've never fallen in love, so you've never been in this part before. I have. It changes. I want the change. I want the next part. I've never had that before. This first part isn't the realest part. The next part, when we stop falling together and land side by side, that's the real part. It's coming. I want it, but I'm afraid that when it comes, when we land, you'll be disappointed and you'll panic. I feel like you're saying that we're under some kind of spell and soon it will wear off and we will love each other less than this. What I'm saying is that soon the spell will wear off and we're going to need to love each other more than this. After a few months, I started noticing that our love shrooms started wearing off. I started to see Abby as separate from me, and I started to feel myself becoming normal again. That was a tragedy for me because I thought that she was the thing that had finally saved me from having to be myself. I thought I could just be us forever now. She was right. I did panic. One night, I wrote her this poem. Colors. 2 years ago, you were pearl white. I was midnight blue. We became sky blue. Pearl gone, midnight gone, all sky blue. But now, sometimes you go to a meeting, to a friend, an opinion, a show. When you go, I'm left with me again. You take your pearl, I feel my midnight again. This is right, I know. Midnight is how I make things. I just thought for a minute that I was gone. I miss being gone. The end of the beginning is existing again. We will be beautiful and strong side by side. But between you and me, between pearl and midnight, I liked sky blue better. I look at that poem now and I think, Glennon, you are always so desperate to find yourself and ready to abandon yourself. You so badly want to be seen and to disappear. You have forever been desperate to yell, here I am, and to fade away at the very same time. Abby and I have been normal people for a couple of years now. We are in the next part now. The initial buzz has worn off, but sometimes we're sky blue again. It's not a permanent state anymore. It comes in fleeting moments. It happens when we make love, steal a kiss in the kitchen, catch each other's eyes when the kids do something amazing. Mostly, though, we're separate colors. This is a beautiful thing because we can really see each other. I have decided that I want to be in love with a person, not a feeling. I want to be found in love, not lost in it. I'd rather exist than disappear. I'm going to be midnight forever. That's perfect. Sandcastles. Ask a woman who she is, and she'll tell you who she loves, who she serves, and what she does. I am a mother, a wife, a sister, a friend, a career woman. The fact that we define ourselves by our roles is what keeps the world spinning. It's also what makes us untethered and afraid. If a woman defines herself as a wife, what happens if her partner leaves? If a woman defines herself as a mother, what happens when the kids leave for college? If a woman defines herself as a career woman, what happens when the company folds? Who we are is perpetually being taken from us, so we live in fear instead of peace. We cling too tightly, close our eyes to what we need to look hard at, avoid questions that need to be asked, and in a million ways insist to our friends, partners, and children that the purpose of their existence is to define us. We build sandcastles and then try to live inside them, fearing the inevitable tide. Answering the question, who do I love, is not enough. We must live lives of our own. To live a life of her own, each woman must also answer, what do I love? What makes me come alive? What is beauty to me, and when do I take the time to fill up with it? Who is the soul beneath all of these roles? Each woman must answer these questions now, before the tide comes. Sandcastles are beautiful, but we cannot live inside them. Because the tide rises, that's what the tide does. We must remember, I am the builder, not the castle. I am separate and whole. Over here, eyes on the horizon, sun on my shoulders, welcoming the tide. Building, rebuilding, playfully, lightly. Never changing, always changing. Guitars. It's late afternoon, and I'm winding down from a 9-hour workday. Abby pops her head into my office and says, "Babe, guess what? I'm going to start playing ice hockey. I found a league that plays Monday nights. I'm looking at gear now. I'm so psyched." Me. Wait. What? You play ice hockey? Abby. No, but I used to play when I was little. My brothers would put me in goal, and I'd just stand there and let the pucks bounce off of me. So fun. Fun. I am confused about fun. Abby is always asking me, what do you do for fun? I find the question aggressive. What is fun? I don't do fun. I am a grown-up. I do family, work, and trash TV. Repeat forever. But we are newlyweds, so I am still sweet. I say, "That's great, honey." Abby smiles, comes over to kiss me on the cheek, then walks out the front door. I stare at my computer. I have so many questions. Why does she get to have fun? Who has the time and money for fun? I'll tell you who. Everyone in this family but me. Craig has soccer, and Chase has photography, and the girls have everything. Everyone has a thing but me. Must be nice to have time for a thing. This must be nice thought stops me. It always does. Maybe it is nice. Maybe that's why they all want a thing. Maybe I want a thing. I sit and think about the one thing I've always wanted to be. A rock star. I am so jealous of rock stars. If I could have one talent I do not have, it would be singing. When I was little, I used to stand in front of the mirror with a hairbrush and transform into Madonna in an arena. Now it's Pink. In my car alone, I am Pink. I am the pinkest. I am pinker than pink. I am deep magenta. I realize that my wife, Madonna, and Pink have rung my doorbell and are delivering a package. I am wildly envious of all of them, and envy is the red flashing arrow pointing me toward what to do next. So I search guitar lessons, Naples, Florida, on my phone. I follow the links. I find a guitar teacher who offers lessons to high school kids in a tiny music store a couple miles from my house. I call her. I set up a time for my first lesson. When Abby walks back through the front door, I meet her in the foyer, alive and bouncing. Me. Hi, can you keep the kids on Fridays after school? Abby. Sure. Why? Me. I'm going to start guitar lessons. My whole life I have wanted to be a rock star, so I'm going to go ahead and be one now. I am going to learn to play the guitar, and then I am going to write my own songs. And when we are at parties, I am going to pull out my guitar, and people are going to gather around and sing along. They will be so happy because they were separate and lonely until my music mixed them all together. And everyone is going to think, She is so cool. And then I will likely get discovered and find myself on a stage somewhere singing 2000s. I won't be good at singing. I know that's what you're thinking. But that is the point. I won't be the kind of singer who inspires people because she's good. I will be the kind of singer who inspires people because she's bad. Like, people will listen to me on stage, and instead of thinking, I wish I could sing like her, they'll think, well, if she can sing up there, then I guess I can do anything. Abby. Okay, babe. Trying to follow all of this. You're starting guitar lessons. This is awesome. And sexy. Wait, did I hear you say that we are going to start attending parties too? Me. No. I love learning to play guitar. It's hard, but it opens up another part of me, one that makes me feel more human. I think the word for this experience might be fun. But to have that fun, I had to climb down from Martyrdom Mountain. I had to allow myself one less thing to sigh about. I had to ask for help. I had to sacrifice some of my moral high ground, perhaps lose a few points in the she who suffers most competition. I think we are only bitter about other people's joy in direct proportion to our commitment to keep joy from ourselves. The more often I do things I want to do, the less bitter I am at people for doing what they want to do. I made my rock star debut on Instagram recently. I played Every Rose Has Its Thorn, and 3 times as many people watched as there are seats in Madison Square Garden. I am just saying, deep magenta. Braids. My ex-husband has a girlfriend. Months ago, we decided it was time for us to meet. The 3 of us arranged to have breakfast at a local restaurant. I arrived first, sat on a bench, played with my phone, and waited. Eventually, I saw the 2 of them approaching, and I stood up. She smiled, and when we hugged, her hair smelled like a flower I couldn't identify. We asked for a table by the water. She and Craig sat down on one side. I sat on the other and placed my purse on the seat next to me. When the waiter came, I ordered hot tea. He delivered it to the table in a little white teapot. I didn't know what else to talk about, so I talked about the little white teapot. I said, "Look at this. How cute is this? My own teapot." The next week, I opened a box in the mail. Inside, there were 2 little white teapots from her to me. When my daughters go to their father's house, she is there with them, and she braids my daughter's hair skillfully. I have never known how to braid my daughter's hair. I've tried, but it ends up looking lumpy and pathetic, so we stick to ponytails. Whenever I see a little girl wearing complicated braids, I think, she looks well-loved. She looks well-mothered. She looks like a little girl whose mother knows what she's doing. Who once was a teenage girl who knew what she was doing, who had lots of friends in high school who all sat around and braided each other's hair and giggled, who was golden. When Craig and his girlfriend drop the kids off at our house, we stand in the foyer together in a little circle, and we are kind and awkward. I tell too many jokes and laugh too often and too loudly. We each do the best we can. Sometimes, while we're standing there, she pulls my girls over, wraps her arms around them, and plays with their hair. When this happens, Abby grabs my hand and squeezes. When Craig and his girlfriend leave, I pull my girls close again. They look well-mothered, and they smell like a flower I can't identify. The kids, Abby and I, got up early this past Thanksgiving morning, piled into the car, and drove to the turkey trot race downtown. On the way, Chase read us a meme that said, "My greatest fear is marrying into a family that runs turkey trots on Thanksgiving morning." Craig and his girlfriend met us there. As we approached the starting line, Craig and Chase went to the front of the pack, their goal to win. Craig's girlfriend, my daughters, and I found a place in the back, our goal to finish, maybe. Abby placed herself in the middle, surveying her goal to make sure everyone achieved their goal. The race began. We stuck together for a while, then drifted apart. Halfway through the race, I saw Craig's girlfriend jogging ahead of me. I've always thought of picking up the pace as something one does metaphorically, but suddenly I felt my feet literally picking up their pace. I began to run instead of jog. I began to run strenuously. I began to run so strenuously that I felt myself sweating and panting. I began sprinting. As I approached Craig's girlfriend, I weaved to the far left so she wouldn't see me pass her. Farther along, I saw Tish running alone, but I didn't slow down. I left her in my dust. My knees started to hurt, but I didn't slow down for my knee either. I crossed the finish line, having beat Craig's girlfriend by a long stretch. Still trying to catch my breath, I grabbed a water and walked back to the finish line to wait for my girls. I scanned the sea of runners finishing and saw Abby, Tish, Emma, and Craig's girlfriend cross the finish line together. Abby had finished early and gone back, rounded up the troops, made sure they all crossed together. They were giggling, happy. Abby on one side, Craig's girlfriend on the other, Emma and Tish in the middle. Nobody seemed to notice my absence or my victory. A few days later, I stood in my driveway and called Craig. I said, "She tells Tish that she loves her. Don't you think that's a little much? She is your girlfriend, not their mother. We all need some boundaries. You need to help her set them. What if she leaves and hurts our kids?" I am much more afraid that she will stay and love our kids. We all ate Christmas dinner together this year. I asked Craig to bring the traditional apple pie. He and his girlfriend brought a strawberry dish instead. When Tish asked where the apple pie was, I shrugged and shushed her. After dinner, we took a family picture, all of us and the dog. After we took it, Craig's girlfriend said, "Okay, now let's do a crazy one." "Why all the suggestions? We don't do crazy ones." All three kids agreed that the crazy picture was the best picture. Then we sat down and ate the strawberry dish. All three kids said it was the best Christmas dessert we'd ever had. The next day, Craig's girlfriend posted our crazy picture online. She wrote, "Grateful to have found a love that is inviting and kind, witty and non-judgmental, a no-boundaries type of love. Someday, I'll learn how to mother with her, with Abby, like a braid. Someday, I'll ask her how to braid my daughter's hair." Seconds. Sometimes, when heated conflict arises between Abby and me, we stop talking, take a breath, and say to each other, "Okay, let's not first marriage this. Let's second marriage this." What we mean is, let's not go on autopilot here. Let's use what we've learned and apply it. Let's be careful and wise and put our egos aside and remember that we are on the same team. Now that we know better, let's do better. I would have described myself as the spiritual director of my first marriage. I had the vision for our plot and Craig fucked it up. I now understand that this is because each person has their own plot. No one can be a supporting actor in someone else's storyline. They can pretend to, but they will always have subplots brewing inside and unfolding outside. I am very controlling. I want to control things. This is because I am afraid. Things feel so precarious. When I was young, I made myself feel safer by controlling my food and body. I still do that. But as I got older and became a wife and a mother, I found another thing to try to control to create safety: my people. Since life is scary and precarious, controlling people I love felt like the responsible thing to do. In addition to the fear factor, there is something else that leads me to want to control things, and that is my belief that I am very smart and creative. I really do believe I have very good ideas and that people would do best if they got on board. This kind of control is called leadership. For a long while, I have controlled and led my people and called that love. I loved my people to a bloody pulp. My role in the lives of the people I love has been as follows. I exist to make all your hopes and dreams come true. So let's sit down and take a look at this comprehensive list of hopes and dreams I've created for you. I have been paying very close attention, and trust me, I see you and know you better than you know yourself. You can do anything I put your mind to. Let us begin. But we cannot feel and know and imagine for other people. This is what I am trying to understand. The person who is teaching me this is my wife. My wife is uncontrollable. I love my wife more wildly than I have ever loved a grown human in my life. Before I met her, I wasn't even all that afraid of dying. Now the thought of death panics me daily, not because of death itself, but because of the idea of not being with her. Death to me is just the ultimate FOMA, fear of missing Abby. Since I love Abby the most, it follows that I have to control her the most. I want to make all of my dreams for her come true. I just really want my best for her. To that end, I have relentless good ideas to share with her about what she should do and wear and eat and how she should work and sleep and read and listen. But every time I try to share my good ideas, overtly or covertly, she somehow knows what I'm doing, calls me out on it, and categorically rejects my efforts. She does this gently. She says things like, "I see what you're doing there, babe. I love you for the effort, but no thank you, I'm good." For the first year of our marriage, I assumed that this was just a fresh, exciting challenge. I assumed that my job was to find new ways to approach her. Here is an actual conversation with my sister during my first year of marriage in response to the problem of Abby's continuing to insist that she was the boss of herself. Me. "Okay, I hear you. But what if I actually know my idea is better for her than her idea is for her? Should I just pretend to think her idea is good? Should I just smile and let her try her idea so we can get to mine when hers doesn't work so well? How long will I have to carry on with this time-wasting charade?" Sister. My God. "Okay, if that's how you have to think of it, Glennon, then yes, try that. Try to fake it till you make it." So that is what I did. I just smiled and faked it. I let her lead, but only because it was my undercover leadership strategy. I decided that we would try things her way for a while until we both saw the light together. For a solid year, we were spontaneous when I preferred a plan. We were trusting of people when I was skeptical. We took big risks even when I had already calculated that the odds were against us. We let the kids try things I was sure they'd fail at and then resent us for forever. We lived, for a while, as if life were less precarious than it is, as if people were better than they are, as if our kids were tougher than I believed them to be, and as if things generally work themselves out. It was reckless and ridiculous and irresponsible. Things do not work themselves out. I work things out. I work them out. And if I don't, there is no working out at all. There is just chaos. I took lots of deep breaths and started a daily yoga practice to deal with my anxiety. And I waited for things to fall apart so I could save us. I kept waiting. Damned if things didn't generally just keep working out. Damned if I didn't start feeling happier. Damned if our children didn't become braver, kinder, more relaxed. Damned if our life didn't get more beautiful. It was annoying as hell, honestly. I really think that it is possible that Abby has good ideas. I am beginning to unlearn what I used to believe about control and love. Now I think that maybe control is not love. I think that control might actually be the opposite of love because control leaves no room for trust, and maybe love without trust is not love at all. I am beginning to play with the idea that love is trusting that other people feel, know, and imagine too. Maybe love is respecting what your people feel, trusting that they know, and believing that they have their own unseen order for their lives, pressing through their own skin. Maybe my role with the people I love is not imagining the truest, most beautiful life for them and then pushing them toward it. Maybe I'm just supposed to ask what they feel and know and imagine. And then, no matter how different their unseen order is from mine, ask what I can do to support their vision. Trusting people is terrifying. Maybe if love is not a little scary and out of our control, then it is not love at all. It is wild to let others be wild. Ideas. One night after dinner, Abby, Craig, my sister, her husband John, and I sat around the kitchen table for hours. Music played in the background, the kids chased honey around the family room, and all of us sipped tea or wine and laughed until it hurt. I pulled honey into my lap, turned toward Craig, and said, "I want to tell you something." Everyone at the table fell quiet. "Do you remember that day, 18 years ago, when we sat side by side on my front porch, me nauseous from morning sickness and you nauseous from shock, trying to decide what to do? Do you remember how you broke the silence? You said, 'I've been thinking, what if we don't get married? What if we just live separately and raise the baby side by side?' You knew. A week before I found out I was pregnant, my friend Christy asked me how it was going with you. I said, 'We have to break up. We can't connect, not physically, not emotionally. It's just not there.' I knew. But I had this idea, a vision of what a family should look like, what you should want, who you should become. My imagination became a dangerous thing when we let it eclipse our knowing. We were so young and afraid back then. We hadn't yet learned that knowing never goes away. It just stays there inside, solid and unmoving. It just waits as long as it takes for the snow to settle. I'm sorry that I ignored our knowing. We didn't fit together. We tried because it was the right thing to do, because we thought we should, because I thought we should. But right is not real, and should is a cage. What's wild is what is. Our knowing was right all along. What is lasted. Because here we are, trying your idea. Being two people who were not made for each other, but who are a hell of a team at raising kids side by side. I hope that whatever you do next is born from you and not imposed on you. I hope the rest of your life is your idea. For what it's worth, I think you should trust yourself. You know what you know. You have good ideas, Craig." Sidelines. My wife and ex-husband play on the same adult league soccer team on Wednesday nights. After dinner, we pack up the car with chairs and snacks, and the kids and I sit on the sidelines and watch their dad and their bonus mom work together to score goals. A few weeks ago, the kids and I were sitting on the sidelines, and an older couple sat down next to us. The woman pointed toward my girls and asked, "Are those your daughters?" "They are," I said. "Is their dad out there playing?" "Yes, he is. That's him." I pointed to Craig. "Where do you all live?" "We live right here in Naples, but separately. He and I are divorced now." "Wow, it's wonderful that you still come watch him play." "Yes, we love watching him play. Also, the girl's mom is playing. We come to watch her, too." The woman looked confused. She said, "Oh, I thought you were their mom." I said, "I am. That's their other mom." I pointed to Abby. The woman looked closely. "Good Lord," she said. "That woman looks exactly like Abby Wambach." "That woman is Abby Wambach," I said. She said, "Wow, your ex-husband is remarried to Abby Wambach?" "Close. I'm married to Abby Wambach." It took her a minute, a full minute of quiet. Selah. Old structural ideas burning, a new order of things being born inside her. Then she smiled. "Oh, wow," she said. Tish's first word was wow. On an early December morning in Virginia, I pulled her out of her crib and walked her over to the nursery window. I lifted the shade, and we both saw that the backyard was covered in white. It was her first snow. Tish's eyes got big. She reached out her hand to touch the cold window, and she said, "Wow." When people encounter our family, their eyes get big, and they say, "Wow," in one tone or another, because they haven't seen a family exactly like ours before. Our family is specific because we are specific people. We did not use a blueprint created by someone else and then struggle to fit each of us inside. We create and recreate our family again and again from the inside of each one of us out. We will continue to do that forever, so each of us will always have room to grow and grow and still belong. That is what family is to me. Where we are both held and free. Levels. 8 years ago, I found myself in a therapist's office asking for strategies to cope with betrayal-induced rage. The therapist said, "Your anxiety is controlling you, which means that you are lost in your head. You don't know what you want. You are so disconnected. You need to remember how to get back into your body somehow." She then suggests that I go to yoga. The next morning, on my way to the studio, I wonder, why did I leave my body to live in this dangerous mind of mine? I sit on my mat in a 90-degree room and immediately remember why. As soon as I get still, the snow settles and I sink into my body. I start to feel itchy and agitated and annoyed. This is why I left, because I am shame and fear wrapped in skin. I don't even want to visit my body, much less reside here. But now I'm stuck. The perimeter of the yoga mat is my entire world. The other women are silent. There is nothing on the walls to read. There is no escape. Where's my phone? There's the door. I could go. I would not have to explain. The instructor walks in, and I ignore her, to continue plotting my escape, until she says, "Be still and know." That phrase again. I so desperately want to know. Whatever it is that I am missing, whatever it is that other people know, whatever it is that helps them cope and lets them just live, I want to know it. So I stayed on that goddamn mat until I knew. Just like I stayed in my addictions until I knew. Just like I stayed in my marriage until I knew. Just like I stayed in my religion until I knew. Just like I stayed in my pain and shame until I knew. And now I know. I'm sitting on my couch between two friends, sipping coffee. My dog's asleep in my friend Saskia's lap. We're all listening to Ashley tell her story about staying in the hot yoga room until it made her sick. After she says, "I mean, the door wasn't even locked," the room falls quiet. Ashley has said something important. Saskia rubs the dog's head. Karen squints her eyes. I think this. The truth of my 30s was, stay on your mat, Glennon. The staying is making you. the truth of my 40s is, I'm made. I will not stay, not ever again, in a room or conversation or relationship or institution that requires me to abandon myself. When my body tells me the truth, I'll believe it. I trust myself now, so I will no longer suffer voluntarily or silently or for long. I'll look at those women to my left and right who must stay, because it's that time for them, because they have to know what love and God and freedom are not before they can know what love and God and freedom are. Because they want to know, because they are warriors. I'll send them every bit of my strength and solidarity to help them through this part. And then I'll pick up my mat and slowly, deliberately, lightly walk out. Because I have just remembered that the sun is shining, the breeze is cool, and these doors, they're not even locked. Epilogue, human. In my favorite holy text, there is a poem about a group of people desperate to understand and define God. They ask, "What are you?" God says, "I am." They say, "You are what?" God says, "I am." What are you, Glennon? Are you happy? Are you sad? Are you Christian? Are you a heretic? Are you a believer? Are you a doubter? Are you young? Are you old? Are you good? Are you bad? Are you dark? Are you light? Are you right? Are you wrong? Are you deep? Are you shallow? Are you brave? Are you weak? Are you shattered? Are you whole? Are you wise? Are you foolish? Are you sick? Are you healed? Are you lost? Are you found? Are you gay? Are you straight? Are you crazy? Are you brilliant? Are you caged? Are you wild? Are you human? Are you alive? Are you sure? I am. I am. I am. Acknowledgements. The reason this book exists, the reason I exist, is because of the people listed here who, each day, breathe my art and me into existence. Abby, if you're a bird, I'm a bird. Chase, you are our family's knowing. Tish, you are our family's feeling. Emma, you are our family's imagination. Craig, for loving our children so masterfully, for trusting me to make art about our new family, for your humor, forgiveness, and relentless goodness. Mom and Dad, for the patient courage that helped me find and keep myself and the love of my life, for trusting me as I learned to trust myself. I vow to give your grandchildren the same gift you give me, to live both held and free. Amanda, the great luck of my life is to call the kindest, bravest, most brilliant person on earth, sister. Everything good in my life is born from that original luck. My sobriety, my family, my career, my activism, my joy and peace. It's all because you walk in front and beside and behind me. I am because of you. Allison, your artistic genius is woven into every word written in here and spoken out there. All of it is ours. Thank you for directing so much of your talent, dedication, loyalty, and friendship my way. You are pure gold. Dina, thank you for pouring yourself and your love into our mission and sisterhood, and for sending us to the moon. Liz B., countless women and children's lives are changed because you see them, believe them, and work so relentlessly for them. I have never seen someone use her one life with more beauty and impact than you use yours. Thank you for being Together Rising's heartbeat. To Together Rising volunteers and warriors Catherine, Gloria, Jessica, Tamara, Karen, Nicole, Natalie, Megan, Aaron, Christine, Ashley, Lori, Kristen, Rhonda, Amanda, Meredith, and Grace, for tirelessly forging that bridge between heartbreak and action. And to Kristen B., Marie F., and Liz G., for investing your exquisite trust in our work. Whitney Frick, for believing when the ideas are invisible and for tirelessly working to help them become real. Margaret Riley King, for your tenacity, vision, humor, wisdom, and friendship. Jennifer Rudolph Walsh, for refusing to abandon our shared unseen order until it became a nationwide dance party. Katie Nishimoto, for your love and loyalty and being the quiet genius behind so many true and beautiful things. For Uncle Keith. For everyone at the Dial Press in Random House, especially Gina Centrello, Avita Basharad, Debbie Aroff, Michelle Jasmine, Sharon Propson, Rose Fox, Robert Seek, Christopher Brand, for working so hard to bring Untamed into the world. I am elated to be on this team with you. Liz G., for being the patron saint of Untamed, a goddamn cheetah, and a believer in magic and freedom and women and me. Karen, Jessica, and Ashley, for calling me friend even though I never text back or leave home. Kat and Emma, for showing me what it looks like to never become tamed in the first place. Here's to untamed women. May we know them. May we raise them. May we read them. May we love them. May we elect them. May we marry them. May we be them. This is Glennon Doyle. We hope that you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Untamed. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Laura Wilson, text copyright 2020 by Glennon Doyle, production copyright 2020 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.